This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's January 29th. I'm Dave Benninger. Happy Friday, everybody. Coming up this week, an overview of the Donlin Gold Mine project that is moving forward in the Kuskokwim.
We're going to need 100 permits before we can operate, and some of those permits deal with fish habitat and mitigation required.
A bill in the legislature aims to make a life-saving heroin antidote more available.
Last year, 54 Alaskans died of opioid painkillers overdoses, and another 34 Alaskans died from heroin overdoses. So the time is now to pass this life-saving legislation.
Plus, a conversation with Robin Samuelson about fishing permit outmigration and what can be done about it.
You know, what are we going to do when we're down to 15% of the permits and we're all sitting on the beach watching the outsiders catch our resource right in our front door?
And members of the band Broken Walls stop by to talk about their message and share a little of their music. Those stories and more are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. A 7.1 magnitude earthquake shook south central Alaska early Sunday morning, causing minor damage around the Anchorage area and also ripping up some roads and destroying four homes in Kenai. Communities nearest to the quake's epicenter didn't notice it as much. Just 30 miles to the west, Carla Jensen in Pedro Bay says she was awake before the quake, probably because her four-legged feline friend knew it was coming.
My cat, who sleeps in the same room, about 5 minutes before that earthquake hit, jumped up on the bed and started meowing and acting real agitated, woke me up, and that's when that first wave hit.
Other Iliamna Lake communities reported feeling only minor shaking Sunday morning. Tragedy struck in the village of Kakanox Saturday when 5-year-old Caden Mann was accidentally shot by an 11-year-old boy while the two were playing video games. Mann was medevaced to Anchorage, where he succumbed to his injuries Sunday morning. Troopers say the boys found the .22-caliber rifle unsecured in the home. A Bethel woman who will serve just 2 years in jail for injecting her father with a dose of heroin that killed him. 35-year-old Shannon Cook pleaded guilty to homicide and misconduct involving a controlled substance. Her father, Thomas Tungwanuk, died in 2014. Cook had faced up to 20 years behind bars. A controversial proposal to increase minimum school enrollment seems unlikely to pass this session, if such a bill is even introduced. Speaking with KDLG this week, Representative Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, says he doesn't believe it would have enough support in the legislature or with Governor Bill Walker.
There are a number of Republicans I've spoken to who oppose it. Every Democrat in the legislature I've spoken to opposes it. And if it passes and the governor vetoes it, I think there are Democratic and Republican votes to sustain a governor's veto. The question then becomes whether the governor vetoes the bill, and I think he would.
So far, no bill has been introduced. Also in education news, Commissioner Mike Hanley announced Tuesday that Alaska will drop the Alaska Measures of Progress standardized test. Dillingham's Danny Frazier is one of many superintendents who say that's good news to hear.
It simply doesn't give us enough information. So you can test a child, but then you don't know how to go back and remediate. So the AMP is out, and we're very happy with our MAP testing that we do because it gives us information about where the child has deficits in their learning.
Alaska students will take AMP one more time this spring while the state puts a bid out for a new standardized test. The commercial halibut catch limit is going up this year. Today, the International Pacific Halibut Commission approved a 30-million-pound catch from Northern California to the Bering Sea, which is about a 2.2% increase. Area 4CDE in Bristol Bay was up to about 400,000 pounds. The number of dead common murres showing up on Alaska's beaches keeps growing. The Fish and Wildlife Service has now gathered more than the 22,000 they collected when the Exxon Valdez went aground in Prince William Sound. They say those collected this year are primarily from easy-to-get-to locations. Yesterday, Governor Walker tapped Dean Williams to head the Department of Corrections in the state. Williams was one of two co-authors of a review of Alaska's jails that is now leading to reforms. His nomination was praised by Senate Republicans. Just days ahead of the deadline to enroll for insurance through Alaska's healthcare exchange, the marker got shorter by one. The Division of Insurance announced yesterday was dropping Oregon-based MOTA, leaving only Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield. And two Bristol Bay elders passed away this week. Lena Bartman Andre, born in Agushik and a longtime Coffee Point fisherman, died at the age of 95. And Mary Hobson of Non-Dalton died at the age of 99 yesterday after a long battle with cancer. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. Now something from the beyond part of our title. Just over the mountains in the next major watershed north, the Donlin Gold Mine is inching towards its permitting phase. The massive project near Crooked Creek on the Kuskokwim River promises a surge of cash and good-paying jobs, plus new infrastructure all the way down to Bethel. But it will also be a huge open-pit mine that will remove a few miles of fish streams and will need long-term maintenance of the waste rock and tailings ponds. A draft environmental impact statement was released last November. The Army Corps of Engineers discusses in plain and frank terms what the mine's estimated effects will be on the land, air, water, and way of life for people in the Kuskokwim. Donlin is a contrast to Pebble in several ways, including in that it has the support of the Calista Corporation for a mineral lease and the Kuskokwim Corporation for surface use. But in terms of the size of the project and how it will shape the future of a region, the two mine projects have some similarities. The draft EIS is now up for public comment, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers held meetings last week in Aniak and Crooked Creek, last night in Anchorage, and will be elsewhere in the region through the end of March. This week, I spoke with Donlin spokesman Kurt Parkin for more on the project.
The Donlin Gold Mine is located about 285 miles, almost due west of Anchorage, and about 10 miles from the village of Crooked Creek in the mountains above Crooked Creek, Crooked Creek being on the Kuskokwim River, upriver from Aniak. And the project itself would be an open pit mine similar to, say, the Fort Knox mine in Fairbanks. It holds about 34 million ounces of gold. And to power the power plant necessary to run the project site, we're going to need about 150 megawatt power plant, which is a very large power plant. And so to provide fuel necessary to fire that power plant, there will be a 315-mile, 14-inch buried pipeline that will run from Cook Inlet to the project site. And that would be buried the entire way with the exception of a couple areas where there's earthquake faults that it would cross, and that would be above ground, similar to what the TAPS line does.
If built, this will be one of the largest gold mine projects in the world. What's the lifespan of this project? What's the construction phase and then the actual mineral extraction phase of this proposed project?
This is a large project, and it's a fairly rich deposit, over 2 grams per ton, which is considered to be fairly rich for this type of a mine. The project life is over 27 years, and the construction phase is about 4 years. And that construction would require the construction of the pipeline. There would be two ports, one in Bethel and one upriver near Crooked Creek. There would be a 30-mile road running from the upper port site to the project site, as well as a runway and a camp and a mill site and the power plant.
Okay. In the draft EIS, there's talk about the size of the footprint there near Crooked Creek. There, it indicates there will be, I think it was 7 or 8 miles of streams lost. Some of these are anadromous, some resident fish populations. These are things that concern all Alaskans, especially up here in salmon country. How does Donlin propose to mitigate some of these impacts with a project of this size? And are you hearing concerns from people in the region about that?
Well, certainly the viability of fish is important to everybody. And the project footprint is about 7,000 acres approximately. And there are drainages that would be used as a part of the footprint. So, for example, the tailings storage would be in one drainage, and then the waste rock would be in another drainage. And there are a few fish that are anadromous in that area, and the mitigation is all part of the discussion with the EIS and the permitting agencies that are going to be permitting the project. We're going to need 100 permits before we can operate, and some of those permits deal with fish habitat and mitigation required.
when you look at the long-term maintenance of tailings facilities, waste rock, and the rest, is Donlin prepared to manage these for the long haul? And how will folks be confident that there won't be impacts 50 years after the project has ended?
Well, I think everybody wants to make sure that it's done right. The way the project is proposed is there would be concurrent reclamation that's done while we're developing the project in an area that we've already used, some of the waste rock storage areas that have already been compiled. We would be doing reclamation on those sites at the time. And then when we're in complete closure, a couple of things that we've done, particularly with regards to the tailings, is some best practices that are not really required by any kind of permit or regulation, but what we thought would be a best practice, and that is having a fully lined tailings facility with a synthetic liner. It'd be the first large mine in the state of Alaska to do that. And then we're also going to do what's called dry closure of the tailings facility, which isn't generally required. But what we do is at the end of the mine life, we pump any of the moisture in the water out of the tailings facility and then cover it with rock and dirt and revegetate it and recontour it. So the tailings, the waste rock facility, the mine or the mill site, all that would be reclaimed and recontoured and vegetated. And then there would be bonding requirements, some kind of financial assurance before we even start that would put in place a mechanism to fund any reclamation that needs to be done should, you know, we not be able to do that. So the state of Alaska is responsible for coming up with the terms for that financial assurance that nothing is left behind without being taken care of.
Kurt Parkin is a spokesperson for the Donlin Gold Mine. The public comment period on the EIS is open now, and meetings are being held throughout the YK region over the next 2 months. Turning to Juneau, Senate Bill 23, sponsored by Democrat Johnny Ellis from Anchorage, would remove the civil liabilities from doctors who prescribe, as well as trained bystanders who administer, the opiate antidote known as naloxone, often called by its brand name Narcan. In other words, SB 23 aims to get the prescription drug, which is not a controlled substance, into the hands of more people who may need it to save lives in cases of opioid overdoses. For more on this, I'm joined by Sarah Evans of Dillingham, who is a legislative aide to Senator Johnny Ellis. Sarah, good morning. Thanks for making time from Juneau.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
Senate Bill 23, what's the importance of this and what is it all about here?
Well, Senator Ellis, about 25 years ago, he read in a New York Times article that in the future, the drug of choice, the drug that was really going to cause an epidemic in our country was not cocaine or crack or anything. It was going to be opioid overdoses from prescription medicine. And so, and we've seen that come to Alaska and hit us hard. And, you know, what it starts out with is, you know, usually younger kids, they get opioid prescriptions for, you know, if they break a leg or if they go to the dentist and get their teeth pulled, and these drugs are very, very addictive. And once they get that, they kind of get addicted to it, and then they start finding it on the street, and the habit gets really expensive with all the pills, and then they turn to heroin because heroin is much cheaper, it's easier to find, and then they get hooked on that. And so actually, Jay Butler, who's our chief medical officer, testified at our latest bill hearing for Senate Bill 23 that last year, 54 Alaskans died of opioid painkillers overdoses, and another 34 Alaskans died from heroin overdoses. 8 of them were just in Juneau alone. So, you know, the time is now to pass this life-saving legislation.
So that's the problem in a nutshell. Tell me what these drugs, naloxone, brand name Narcan, could do, and how does the bill make them more accessible?
Right. Okay. So naloxone is a prescription drug. It's not a controlled substance and has no abuse potential. It's most commonly injected into like a vein or muscle for fast action, or there's also a nasal spray that you can spray. And what it does is when someone is having an overdose, through opioid or heroin, their brain receptors get covered by the opioid. And what Narcan does is it goes into there and it clears off those receptors so that if a person stops breathing during an overdose, once those receptors get wiped clean of the opioids, they work again, and then the person is able to start breathing on their own. So literally, if you're having an overdose and your lips are blue, your fingers are blue, you're not breathing, or you're very small breath, all of a sudden you're just back to life. And the best thing about Narcan is that if you have no opiates in your system and somehow a Narcan is injected into you, it has no side effects whatsoever. It's a very safe drug.
Sarah, you're a legislative aide for Senator Ellis, who's a veteran of the state legislature. And one thing that people kind of know about is that legislative aides like yourself actually do a lot of the legwork on some of these pieces of legislation before the senator puts his signature on it and goes around the halls lobbying for it with folks and everything else. This is kind of your baby, right?
Well, I came into this bill. It had already been introduced, and a previous staffer, Amory Lelake, really got this bill moving. But I've stepped in and I've taken control over it, and it is my baby. I care a ton about this bill and passing it as soon as possible so that we can start saving lives. And so, you know, I work it with through staffers. I'm in offices every single day talking about our bill, trying to get a hearing on our bill so that we can get it passed.
We'll keep an eye on it from here. Sarah Evans, good to speak with you, and thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. At this point in the snowless winter, everyone's a few months into their favorite indoor coping mechanism. Many pass the time socializing through games. For generations, it's been Pinochle and Bingo, but of course the younger folks have their games of choice as well. KDLG's Hannah Colton has this story about a Dillingham group where wizards battle monsters on a weekly basis.
It's Monday after school, and Andrew Slagle's classroom is full of more than the usual handful of students needing math help. There's 8 or 10 boys and a few adults, and they're pairing off to play a game called Magic: The Gathering. I drift toward one corner where a dark-haired teenager is shuffling magic cards like I've never seen cards shuffled before.
My name is Matthew Kraus, and I'm a cardist. It's doing cardistry like flourishes like this, fans, cuts.
Here, Mr. Slagle chimes in with some light trash talking.
He likes to flourish his cards in order to intimidate and distract his opponents. Right, Matthew?
Yep.
Okay, just don't flash the cards to your opponent when you're flourishing, or else they might see. Okay.
Matthew's opponent is Christian Olson, a newbie to the world of magic.
And this is like my fourth time ever playing, and I never won, ever.
They start the game by drawing 7 cards each.
Now you gotta roll to see who goes first.
Wow.
I go first.
And right when it gets to your turn, you draw a card.
The cards are a mix of spells, creatures, and lands, and they're all divided into 5 colors. The boys explained to me, the red cards do lots of damage, green makes things go faster, blue is for control, and black, they tell me, lets you do crazy spells. Then white is the color of justice, and it restores life points.
Okay, so now I'm going to buy a creature. I'm going to flip this land. I'm going to flip this one, too. Then boom, put this down. Now I got a creature on the field.
Christian uses his creature to attack Matthew, cutting down his life points. The object of the game, they explain, is to be the last player standing. There's no board or game pieces. Still, Christian likens it to a classic strategy game.
It's like really crazy chess, but better and cooler. Yeah.
I wander to another table to find 7th grader Sawyer Sands dealing a winning blow.
Wait, which is mine? I just took control of his creature, which was an 8-8, a very, very powerful monster. And then I equipped my card to it, which made it even more powerful, and I attacked him with it.
Sawyer is big into magic. He's the one who started Card Club this fall, and he plays a lot with his friends and his dad, Tim Sands.
You know, he's kind of a logical thinker, and there's a lot of logical thinking involved in the Card Club stuff. You know, if he wants to beat me, he's going to beat me. He'll get out his better deck, you know. He has all the decks. He knows what they are and how they work. And I mean, I'm a neophyte, so I don't know that much.
Sawyer downplays his expertise. He says it's all about having good cards, and he just has a lot of decks.
Well, there's skill in it, no doubt, but it all comes down to chance. Even the best can lose to the worst.
Around the room, there are some kids standing, just watching their friends play. Jaden Mayer is a freshman. He's fairly new to the club, and he also plays basketball. He says he's the only one on the team who also goes to Card Club.
And some other people, they don't really go. They usually go out of town or hang out with their friends, and that's it.
So why is it better for you to come here than, like, go?
Because I don't really like going to town and spending all my money. And I kind of like being with the people that I'm kind of comfortable with than my buddies doing social media and doing stuff that I don't really like.
How would you describe your buddies here?
At Card Club, they're nice. They're really friendly to talk with. They just like doing what they do.
What they do is complicated, entertaining, and sometimes ruthless. I head back to the first table to check in and find out Christian has just defeated Matthew in one fell swoop.
I took down 13 health in one turn.
I didn't shuffle right.
He tapped all his stuff. And
are you blaming your flourish shuffle?
Mm-hmm. I'm never going to do that again. I quit it.
It's because he tapped everything.
Wait, didn't you say you've never won before?
Yeah, I just won. My victory! Tell the world.
Matthew is frustrated. He's pretty competitive. But this is magic. The cards always come up different. And there's always the next game. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond. A couple of weeks ago, more than 100 fisheries stakeholders gathered in Anchorage to talk about the dwindling participation in state fisheries by state residents, particularly by those who lived nearest to the fisheries. About a dozen from Bristol Bay were present for the two-day conversation. That's a conversation we want to have here on KDLG, so our Molly Dishner invited longtime drift fisherman Robin Samuelson, who also chairs the board of BBEDC, in to talk it over.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You were in Anchorage for the Fisheries Access Workshop organized by the University of Alaska Sea Grant. How did you get involved in that?
I've been concerned for quite a while. I got my limited entry permit when the state handed out limited entry permits. But over the years here in Bristol Bay, I've seen the exodus of permits. And from not only Dillingham, but the surrounding villages within Bristol Bay. And it really concerned me. You know, prior to World War II, our people basically weren't allowed to fish in Bristol Bay. The canneries brought up the people from the lower 48. They fished. With World War II, all them white fishermen went and joined the army. And the fish companies wanted fishermen, and they hired locals to go fishing. And then with the advent of power boats, our people got more and more into the fishery. Hence came limited entry. It was adopted in 1973, instituted in 1975. Immediately, permits were selling. Back then, drift permits were selling for $1,500, if not less. Then in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, we're seeing a mass exodus. And it's hard not to blame the people of Bristol Bay. People in the village, when they fall on hard times, they have two things that they could sell. And one is a drift permit and one is a native allotment. Usually they pick the set net permit or a drift permit and sell that to get some money into the family to help the family survive. You know, when a guy's back or a gal's back is up against a wall, you gotta feed the family. I watch these permits exit the bay, and it's getting to be real crucial. We have way less than 50% of the permits. What are we going to do when we're down to 15% of the permits, and we're all sitting on the beach watching the outsiders catch our resource right in our front door? What are we going to do when if the state cuts the budgets like they say they're going to cut, does away with LIHEAP, does away with energy assistance? I mean, I could go on and on what the state probably do. It's going to affect my people here in Bristol Bay. If they had limited entry permits, we could continue fishing.
Some other Dillingham residents were also there, including Alice Ruby, who gave a presentation on the programs BBEDC already offers that help residents get permits. What are some of the reasons we heard about why those programs aren't always used and why this outmigration of permits is still occurring?
Well, a lot of people don't qualify for a loan. If you own child support, you don't qualify for a loan. If you have back taxes, you don't qualify for a loan. The BBDC programs are not giveaway programs. You need to qualify for each and every one of the programs. A lot of our people qualify for the loans, but a lot of them do not qualify.
What other ideas did you hear at the workshop that could help?
The bill that Jonathan, the representative out of Sitka, has put together, it'll probably come out of House Resources Fisheries Committee. It's for each region of the state, whether you're in the Bristol Bay region, the Kodiak region, the Prince William Sound region, the Southeast region, you're going to have one commercial fishery permit bank that could be formed. And you could acquire up to 10, I think it's 10 permits at a time that would sit in this bank, and you could turn around and lease them to younger people to fish for 3 to 5 years until they get their feet on the ground, saved up enough money to acquire their own set or drift permits. Pretty innovative. I think it'll work.
If a permit bank was created here in Bristol Bay, do you have any ideas on how it would get funding, particularly given those state budget concerns?
Well, that's one of the problems. It's all focused around borough governments and city governments. I don't agree with that concept. I think our tribal government should be involved, as well as BBDC. The likely choice to form a Bristol Bay permit bank would be BBDC. They're doing a lot of things in the fisheries to help all the villages in Bristol Bay, not just the 17. They currently have the financing to back a program up and start such a program. The way the bill is written right now, it's only the city councils and the borough councils, and it's got to be a two-thirds vote. I see some real heartache with getting two-thirds vote. But if you go through a committee, I think that we could work the problems out in committee.
We'll keep an ear out for that. Thanks for coming in today, Robin.
Thank you.
And finally today, this weekend the band Broken Walls is in Dillingham. Along with the nonprofit group Carry the Cure, they are using their music to inspire youth and combat depression and teen suicide. Band members Bill Pagaran and Jonathan Miracle join me now. Pleasure to have you both in the studio. Thanks so much.
And welcome, great to be here.
Welcome
good
to town,
here.
By the way.
We're beautiful
excited
place
to have
here.
So let me come to you first, Jonathan. You formed the band Broken Walls more than 20 years ago.
1995, I got the vision to do it, yeah.
Introduce us to Broken Walls, if you don't mind.
Okay, well, I went to a gathering one day, and it was in Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada. And while I was at the gathering, there was an elder speaking, and he was talking about the walls of bitterness that are built in the hearts of Indigenous people around the world. And he was saying how these walls of bitterness must be broken in order to bring strength and, you know, honesty and honor back to mankind, basically, he was saying. And it was a big thing he was speaking about. But as he was talking about these walls of bitterness being broken, I had a vision to see these walls broken. And I'm a musician, so it came through my music, and I wrote a song right on the spot that I sang, and then this wonderful time of forgiveness began to happen among about 800 people of various religions and cultures. All were in the room, and they began confessing their attitudes towards one another and asking for forgiveness of one another in a public situation. And so to me, that was a groundbreaking foundational experience to build a future on. And I've been doing it over 21 years now.
21 years.
Yeah.
Bill, I'm going to come over to you. You are a member of Broken Walls, but you're also the president of an organization called Carry the Cure. Can you introduce us to that?
Sure. Well, Carry the Cure was inspired by the Iditarod. And most Alaskans know that the Iditarod is actually a celebration of another race, the Great Sirim Race of 1925, which in western Alaska and the Nome area, there was an epidemic of diphtheria that threatened to wipe out the village and the people there. But they developed a serum, they developed a cure, and brave dog mushers risked their lives to carry that serum across the Yukon River. And so years ago, Carry the Cure was doing a suicide prevention school assembly in Nome, and just remembering, wow, you know, this race that we're watching these mushers, you know, finish, that race began like I just described. And so we were there doing suicide prevention, and we thought, wow, there's another epidemic in Alaska today, and it's depression, it's suicide, but there's a cure. So we need to carry the cure to the villages of Alaska. So that's what inspired it. So we've been carrying a message of life, hope, and destiny over all the people of Alaska. And it's really, its roots, of course, is in the gospel, that each person is fearfully and wonderfully and beautifully created. And so we carry that message, you know, in different ways all throughout Alaska. And now, since I've been a drummer with Broken Walls for about 9 years, we've been taking it all around the world.
Jonathan, how does the music enhance or help amplify the message?
Oh, it brings a real strength to it, because music has a very emotional aspect to it. And you know, when Bill does the Carry the Cure program, he appeals to the hearts of the young people and says, you know, let's change. Let's bring let's see a future. Let's bring honor back to who we are. Let's honor our ancestors, and let's honor the land, and let's honor one another. And when we do that, and then Bill is like one of my favorite drummers in the world. And when Bill plays his drums, he draws the attention of the people. And the young people listen to him, and they admire what he does. And so they're completely willing to listen to what he has to say too after that, because if you can play drums that good, then you must have something good inside you, you know? And so he does. He releases this great passion. And the drum is a unifying force that seems to call to all Native people. And it helps to, you know, when we play, you'll see how we start off with the drum, and the drum just kind of has this uniqueness of bringing a oneness into the room where we think together.
Awesome. You're soon to release your 9th studio album. Tell us about it, and any chance we could get a sneak preview before it comes out?
Yeah. The album is called The Path. And we're talking about a path that we follow that leads us to being a strong part of our community, that leads us to having an understanding of who our Creator is. The song that we'll give you is called Now Is the Time.
It's time to give. It's time for giving of what you have inside. It's a call to all people to join our hands together and sing a new song.
That'll do it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at the KDLG website. I'm Dave Bettinger. Thanks to Molly Dishner and Hannah Colton for their help this week. And also thanks to my guests here from Broken Walls, Jonathan Miracle and Bill Pagaran. You played us in. Do you mind playing us out?
That'd be awesome. Yeah, we can do that.
Bye-bye, everybody. We'll see you back here next week.